This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Are you driving your car or doing laundry right now? Podcasts go best when they're bundled with another activity. Like Progressive home and auto policies, they're best when they're bundled too. Having these two policies together makes insurance easier and could help you save. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. Quote a home and car bundle today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On the Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to the Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and the New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. As summer marches on and fall comes into view, the question of schools is coming into sharp focus. A debate, a full-on battle really, is raging about whether schools should reopen their doors for kids.
Yeah, the president has said unmistakably that he wants schools to open, and I was just in the Oval talking to him about that. And when he says open, he means open and full, kids being able to attend each and every day at their school. The science should not stand in the way of this.
But if you're the teacher standing face to face with 35 kids, or if you're a principal for that matter, or an education official, or a governor, you may want to consider the science. But that gets tricky. This pandemic is not much more than half a year old, and there's no definitive set of data to guide us. So what do we know about this seemingly impossible problem? The New Yorker's Joshua Rothman talked last week with Emily Oster, an economist at Brown University. Oster has written bestsellers on pregnancy and parenting from a data-based perspective, and she co-authors the website COVID Explained.
So maybe we should start with the first of three questions, which is, how dangerous is the coronavirus to children?
I think the answer is that this is the least affected group. So that's different than saying it's not dangerous. And some of the things you will hear are people saying, you know, oh, kids can't get it. Kids don't get it. No kids ever get it. That's not true. Kids can get it. They can get very sick. There have been pediatric deaths. We now have a lot of data from a lot of different locations that really suggest that kids tend to have mild illness and they are less likely to get sick. So I think that piece of it is pretty reassuring.
And does anyone know why? Why would that be?
So there's some discussion, and now we're like a little bit beyond my science skills, but there's some discussions about ACE2 inhibitors and like different levels of ACE2 enzymes. But I don't think we really have an answer to that question yet.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, one thing I've been like low key freaking out about for myself, I have a 2-year-old son, and we were, you know, our version of this debate was sending him to pre-K. And, you know, I had read the papers about how, you know, like basically the kind of scary version of COVID is something that kids don't really seem to get in any kind of significant numbers. But then I was starting to, you know, learn about like, you know, there are things that happen decades after you get a virus, like shingles is a consequence of chicken pox, or there are like various weird things that happen like 10 years after you get the measles. I mean, how do you think about it being an unknown virus, I guess is what I'm asking, or a new weird creepy virus?
Yeah, I mean, I think that that is part of what's hard, is that people are sort of constantly running through their heads, well, what if in 20 years we find out that this had this long-term impact that we didn't know about it? And I think, yes, you know, you're right that that's really scary. Now, that's always true, right? So there's you're kind of frequently experiencing things where we don't really know, or experiencing things where we do know that there are potentially long-term consequences, like the flu. Flu is actually way more dangerous than COVID for kids based on the data. And so you're already kind of taking some of these risks. And I think that they're just not really salient every day. But the fact that like there could be something bad that happens later, is hard to factor into your decision making because, of course, there could always be something bad that happens later, and you cannot wait 20 years to decide whether to send your 2-year-old to daycare.
Yeah. Yeah, that totally makes sense. So what about kids being vectors or giving the virus to each other?
So this is a place where I think we have sort of growing data, but it is actually more complicated and less, like, it's less obvious than the case of how sick kids get. So so for a while, there was some discussion, like, kids don't transmit. Like, they don't transmit at all, so we shouldn't, like, worry about that. I think what is true is they do seem to transmit less. We have a number of, I would say, examples that are reassuring. So cases where there was an infected kid and they interacted with a lot of other people and nobody got sick. I think our best data on this probably just came out, and it's like a little bit mixed. So there's a big study from South Korea, which looked at a bunch of cases and then looked at their contacts. So South Korea does much better contact tracing than elsewhere. So they had traced, you know, they have like 6,000 cases and 60,000 contacts.
Right.
So to put some numbers on it, so if you have a little kid in the study who has COVID, that's a kid under 10, they find only about 5% of their parents or people they live with get COVID. So that's a really low transmission rate. It's much lower than other groups. So adults look like the transmission rate there would be something like 11 or 12%. So that would say adults would transmit to 11 to 12% of people in their household. For kids in their teens, that's the 10 to 19 age group, they were still much less likely to be infected than other people in the population. But conditional on being infected, they transmitted to their household contacts at a rate that was sort of similar to adults. So there's a little bit of a mixed bag for the older kids, and suggests there's an important difference between the younger and the older age groups within kids.
So, I mean, does that suggest that we should be having two pretty distinct conversations, like one about high school kids, essentially how to keep those schools closed, and then one about elementary school kids and essentially how to open those schools?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it's unreasonable to say that we should privilege different groups differently for this reopening conversation. One of the ways we could do that is with age. And we could say basically we should be thinking about how to open for elementary school kids and maybe about how to use space in high schools or in middle schools to like de-densify our elementary school classrooms. And the other piece of this that lines up well with that kind of plan is that the kind of distance learning losses, like how good is distance learning, is pretty different for little kids and for older kids. So it's not that easy to teach a 5-year-old on Zoom. And also some of what you're trying to convey is sort of like, how do you interact with other 5-year-olds? Whereas for high school kids, of course, like socialization is important. It's easier for them to socialize on their own. And also the like learning piece, it's easier to do on the computer. So I think that's not crazy. I think the other place that that we should sort of be talking about prioritization is to just recognize that people have different resources. And so, you know, within a bunch of sixth graders in a large urban school district, you're going to have kids where, you know, their parents can be home with them and, you know, they are capable of like supervising them doing online learning. And then you're going to have cases where kids, you know, live in homeless shelters or in other kinds of unstable environments with no internet. And we should prioritize those kids for in-person education if we have to choose, I think.
And then on the third question, which is adults who work in schools giving it to one another. What do we know about that?
So I think that what we know about that is kind of the same as what we would know about this in any kind of office setting. And I think we have to think the same would need to be true about schools. You know, we can't have faculty break rooms. We can't have faculty kitchens. You know, we're going to need to think about PPE. I mean, there's a lot of those kind of considerations that are going into opening offices that I haven't seen talked about as much in the cases of schools. So we spent a lot of time in schools on sort of thinking about the protections that have to do with interactions between teachers or between staff and students, and much less about the interaction between staff and staff, which of course probably are the highest risk interactions because those are the people who are, you know, most likely to spread it to each other.
So I imagine you as a person who's just at the center of a huge amount of communication from parents, from teachers, from education people about this problem, this question. I guess part of it is a lot of places thought, well, there were a lot of people thinking that in a sort of wishful thinking way that this would just automatically be over by, you know, at some point in the summer. And maybe this is just one of those decisions that's so hard to make. You can't guarantee anything to anybody.
I think one of the things places thought that they were going to be able to somehow think about this in a sort of like cost and benefit trade-off way. And then it became like very emotional in a way that maybe wasn't expected and makes it very hard to make decisions like that. So, you know, when you announce that you're going to reopen schools and then people are like, do you want me to die? You like, you know, basically when the teachers union comes and they say like, do you want me to die? Like you want me to go, you're going to make me go to work so I can die. And then you realize as an administrator, like if you reopen schools, in fact, even if you don't reopen schools, in general, there will be some people who are teachers who unfortunately will die because a lot of people are going to die of COVID because it is a terrible disease that we really need to like be addressing more aggressively. But it like it, what's going to happen if you open schools is that some people are going to, you know, are going to get this and some of them may die. And then what are you going to do? And so I think that was the thing that sort of people came up against that they maybe weren't expecting.
Right. Like normally, this is in fact, on some level, it's a life and death decision, even though on another level, it's an education. It's about, well, let me frame it a different way. I mean, how much do we know about what it means for kids to miss a year of school? Is that something we know about? Like what the impacts are on children who are out of school for a year?
Yeah. So I think we know that it is really bad for kids to lose out on schooling. And we know that like there were very large learning losses in the spring. Those learning losses are concentrated in students of color and low-income students. I mean, they're concentrated in low-income schools. You can see this in the data. It's comparable. You know, it's the same thing we see when we look at summer learning loss. If we go online for a school year and, you know, things are anything like they were in the spring, there are going to be a bunch of kids who drop out. Those are going to be from particular demographic groups. You know, we're going to see basically an exacerbation of some pre-existing inequalities. I mean, we saw this today, like all of my Twitter feed today is about educational pods. Oh, we're going to have a learning pod. We're going to have a learning bubble. Guess who's having learning bubbles? It's the rich, right? Or at least, you know, people who are like relatively better off than the average. And so I think all of this stuff is going to be very bad in the long term. And we know that people who get less education have worse health outcomes later, make less money, have all kinds of other sort of long-term impacts. And I have made this point in various ways. And one of the pieces of pushback you get is, you know, well, it would be worse to be dead. If you open schools and even one kid dies of COVID as a result of school openings, then that's worse than all of these learning losses. We don't really have a way to talk about how we trade those things off. Economists have a framework, but it's the kind of reason that people hate us, right? Because we're going to go out there and say, well, you know, the long run, like mortality, higher mortality among this entire cohort of students outweighs the like life years lost of one student dying of COVID. But nobody wants to be out there saying that. I mean, I don't want to be saying that. Nobody wants to say that. And I think that that's part of what makes this just really hard to talk about.
So, I mean, what would it be better for school districts to just decide now very clearly, you know, to avoid being, you know, the flat squirrel and just decide we're going to pursue opening and then there's certain consequences that flow from that in terms of decisions that need to be made, or to decide we're going to sort of be as conservative as possible and then, you know, pull all your resources into making it work that way? Is flip-flopping bad here?
Yes, flip-flopping is bad. And I think this is something, like a lot of school districts had this attitude of we're just going to wait as long as possible to have as most information as possible. And I think it was driving parents crazy. And there actually are like a number of people, even in California, where like, so I texted a friend of mine the other day. And I was like, I'm so sorry that LA has decided not to open. And she was basically like, you know, like I just am glad that I know. Because now I can like, yes, I wish we could be in person, but now at least I understand what I'm up against. Parents were like, okay, let me try to think about like, how am I going to make this work? The piece that I'm worried about, from just to tell you about like what is keeping me personally up at night about my life, is that I live in a place where there's currently the plan is to open schools in person, like more or less full time, at least for elementary schools.
But I am worried that we're going to get 2 weeks in and there's going to be, you know, a case in my kid's school. And like, you know, realistically, that's even with a low prevalence place, like that's going to happen. And that then I'm not sure what the plans are in terms of like the reaction, right? So it would almost be worse to send the kids back for 2 weeks and then have to pull them out again because I wouldn't be prepared for that.
Now, what if you lived in a state, like a state where you just didn't trust the decision-making about coronavirus? I mean, I think that's a situation a lot of parents around the country are in or worry that they may be in. This is one of these weird moments where everyone is making their own judgment calls about what's safe, what's acceptable, I guess.
So I think that... I think it's very, you know, I think that in that case, a lot of people are going to be thinking about it as it's not a good idea to send my kid. And I suspect that I would be in the same boat. You know, I'm pretty into school. And so I'd really like my kids to be in school, but I'm not sure that, you know, from a public health standpoint, I could really decide to send them, even if I wasn't worried about them at all. I'm not sure it would be a good idea to decide to send them in a place with, where, you know, a lot of people are being infected every day, partly because I would just feel like that was not like socially the choice that I would make. But I also think we're going to have to accept that there isn't actually a right choice in that people are going to differ in what they think is the right thing to do. And that we probably, it's not going to help any of this discourse for people to yell at each other and tell them they're doing it wrong. It's just hard to put yourself in other people's shoes on those kind of choices.
Emily Oster, an economist from Brown University. She's also the author of Crib Sheet and Expecting Better. She spoke with The New Yorker's Josh Rothman. This is The New Yorker Radio Hour. More to come.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
WNYC Studios is supported by Rocket Money. Did you know nearly 75% of people have subscriptions they've forgotten about? Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. Rocket Money will even try to negotiate your bills for you by up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/WNYC. That's rocketmoney.com/WNYC.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick.
Welcome, my lord.
My liege.
How far off lies your power?
Nor near nor farther off, my gracious lord, than this weak arm. One day too late, I fear me, noble lord, hath clouded all thy happy days on earth.
Free Shakespeare in Central Park is one of the true New York City glories. But even outdoor theater was canceled this summer. So Shakespeare in the Park took to the radio, recording a production of Richard II for WNYC. The story, of course, is about a weak, indecisive king who loses control and faces a rebellion by his cousin.
For God's sake, let us sit upon the ground and tell sad stories of the death of kings. How some have been deposed, some slain in war, some haunted by the ghosts they have deposed, some poisoned by their wives, some sleeping, killed, all murdered. For within the hollow crown that rounds the mortal temples of a king keeps death his court, and there the antic sits, scoffing his state and grinning at his pomp, allowing him a breath, a little scene to monarchize, be feared and killed with looks, infusing him with self and vain conceit, as if this flesh which walls about our life were brass impregnable and humored thus, comes at the last and with a little tin bores through his castle wall. And farewell, king.
Andre Holland plays King Richard.
I just want to take away all the, like, just all the dust that's on the play, these received ideas we have about, like, how we have to revere the language and it's meant to be this and that, and we have to come to it with a certain amount of intellectual understanding. Nah, man, it's just people who live in their lives, and I hope that that's what people who listen to the play take away from it. You know, when I think about Black people in the South, you know, we kind of naturally speak in this, like, iambic pentameter kind of way at times. Mm-hmm. Like when I speak to my pops, for example, you know, I call down and, you know, how you doing, man? How's your day going? He might say, well, I can't kill nothing and look like won't nothing die, you know? And so when I hear, you know, when I read Shakespeare and it sits in me in a cool way. And there's a lot of people who say that actually the way that the Elizabethans would have spoken Shakespeare is very, very, very close to the American South, the sound of the American South, mm-hmm. you know? So I think it just sits in my mouth in a cool way. I think it just fits, I feel at home in it.
You can hear Andre Holland talking with Vincent Cunningham on a special episode of our podcast, and the complete production of Richard II is at wnyc.org/Shakespeare. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. Immigration has been and remains an obsession of the Trump presidency. Asked about the pandemic, Trump inevitably points to his ban on flights from China in January. The administration is still fighting to rescind DACA, even after a Supreme Court defeat. And for years now, they've even spoken about ending birthright citizenship.
A week before the midterm elections, President Trump said he could end so-called birthright citizenship with a stroke of his pen.
A person comes in, has a baby, and the baby is essentially a citizen of the United States for 85 years with all of those benefits. It's ridiculous.
That's despite the fact that it's in the Constitution.
We all know what the 14th Amendment says. We all cherish the language of the 14th Amendment. But the Supreme Court of the United States has never ruled on whether or not the language of the 14th Amendment, subject to the jurisdiction thereof, applies specifically to people who are in the country illegally. And I think
But the birthright citizenship we have as Americans is the exception, not the rule. Not one country in Europe, for example, automatically grants citizenship to any child born there.
There's basically two main systems in the world, and they use Latin terms. So there's jus soli, law of the soil, and there's jus sanguinis, law of the blood, right? We have jus soli in the U.S., like law of the soil. You're born on the soil, you have the citizenship.
Gofen Mputubwele is one of our producers, and he also happens to be a lawyer, so let's trust him on the Latin.
In Italy, they have jus sanguinis, right? This idea of lineage, descendancy, right? Initially, that meant like you're descended from another Italian man. What that means is that if you're the offspring or the descendant of Italians anywhere on the planet, you have the right to citizenship. Bill de Blasio's kids have the right to Italian citizenship because Bill de Blasio is descended from an Italian seed.
For the past 2 years, Gofen has been working on a story about citizenship, immigration, and race in a context that's very different from the United States. And before we start, a note of warning. Telling the story involves a racial slur that was directed at one of the characters, and there's really no way around it, so be advised. Here's GoFan.
I studied Italian in college. I sang classical singing, opera. So I like keep up with Italy stuff. And like there was a certain point in my life where I was like confronting the whiteness of my spaces, the spaces that I was in, and the fact that in Italy, like all my friends were white. And that bugged me. And so I remember at some point kind of being like, I actually haven't even heard a Black Italian. I started following a bunch of them on YouTube, on Instagram, etc. And there's this one woman in particular. Her name is Bellamy Ogak.
Quando ero piccola, detestavo I miei capelli.
She has this blog and like YouTube page and stuff called Afro-Italian Souls, an aggregating site for Black Italian stuff that's going on. And Bellamy is like classically Italian.
I like clothes, you know, I like doing my makeup, I like going out and being, you know, put together.
Her dad was a doctor.
I attended Catholic private schools from kindergarten up to high school.
This was like a very preppy, fancy Catholic school.
Kids wearing Gucci belts, Louis V belts, Louis V shoes.
Bellamy was only, she was like one of two or three Black people at the school.
When you are the only one of your kind, you are extremely visible all the time. I wanted to be as invisible as possible.
But we start talking about her experience, and she tells me, like,
I was so blessed to live in a place where I never faced overt racism, like, at all. It was very, very rare.
Anything that happened was subtle. What was a kind of thing that would happen to you in high school that you put in the category of like a racist thing about or whatever?
Well, the N-word, they used to say negro di merda. Negro di merda means dirty N-word, you know? All my friends were like, oh, F African people, F Black people, F immigrants. We hate them, we despise them, they're trash. But you're different because you were born and raised here. You are eloquent. You don't act like them.
I'm so curious that, like, that doesn't sound like subtle racism.
Well, that to me was subtle because I've heard that word since I was like 5 years old. Yeah, I go to a cafe with my godparents who are white, and you see other elder white Italian people coming to me, caressing me, and say, oh, che bella negretta, which means, oh, you're such a cute little nigger. Like, you're such a cute little nigger girl. Since I was like 3, 4, 5 years old. I realized that I wasn't a citizen when I think I was 14 or 15-ish. I wanted to apply for study holidays in England. I went to this website and you have to indicate your nationality. That's when I realized that I was like, oh, my nationality is technically Uganda. And since it's Uganda, I could see that I had to apply for a visa. And then I went to the website of the Ugandan embassy and the British embassy. And when I realized all the steps that I had to take in order to attend that course, that's when it hit me. That's when I went to my parents and I was like, wait, why are things like this? And that's when they explained to me.
And do you remember at all, like, how your parents explain things to you?
Well, African parents are very particular. They're very particular. Well, first of all, no empathy at all.
I feel like this is an important point where I should say, I love you, mom and dad.
Like, they were like, listen, this is the way it is. White people are trash. African people cannot go anywhere because that's just the way it is. And until you become an Italian citizen, that's what you have to go through. I couldn't even talk about it with anyone because I was ashamed. I was honestly ashamed and embarrassed.
Bellamy isn't alone. She's part of a generation of Black Italians, kids of African immigrants who came in and around the 80s. So my parents are from the Democratic Republic of Congo. My parents and her parents left the African continent around the same time. My parents landed in the U.S. I was born in a hospital in Indiana. Bellamy was born near Milan. I'm born and I'm automatically an American citizen. She's born and she's Ugandan. Because of jus sanguinis, remember, law of the blood, if you're the child of an immigrant to Italy, you have to wait until you're 18 to apply for citizenship, and you have to apply between your 18th and 19th birthday. If you don't apply in that 1 year, you lose your right to citizenship. You could live to be 99, never set foot outside of Italy, but you are still a foreigner. So like 2 years ago, I reach out to Bellamy and Bellamy's like, you should come, a couple of my friends. We meet every once in a while and talk about these kinds of things.
Testing, 1, 2, 3.
So I'm like, oh, sweet.
Just walking through streets of Milan to get
I go to this address.
This little meeting.
And then I show up and it's like the artiest art studio apartment. It felt like a salon.
We usually go for wine because we are bougie like that.
They have like jollof rice and plantains or whatever, these pieces of African culture that make me feel at home. In the beginning, when I first enter this Black Italian universe, it's just me, Bellamy, and about 4 or 5 of her friends.
So yeah, we're just waiting for a few people in the meantime.
But then people start filing into this room in Milan. Bellamy's close friend David walks in.
Please! I was just talking about you!
And by the time everyone's there, there's like 20, 25 people.
We have two more singers arriving, actually.
Okay.
So
cool.
I'll just like kind of throw out questions and I'll move around and like come to you. Like I'm trying to get at what does it look like to live as a Black Italian in Italy? Anyone, feel free.
There's this lull.
Do not be shy.
Someone even says like, "Oh my gosh, guys, we're so timid."
But as they loosen up, everyone has stories that are the various ways that white Italians have told them that they're not supposed to be here as Black people in Italy.
It's jokes, humor.
Wow. Yes.
That's the one of their stronger weapons to let you know that you're Black, that you're different.
Of course, my parents, they are African, but I was born here. I have both of the cultures.
Whenever they see me, they try to enunciate Italian. I'm like, how do you assume that I am not Italian?
I want to be straight.
They start having this kind of like back and forth where someone's like, I don't know if Italy is a racist country.
I strongly believe that Italy is an ignorant country.
They don't feel like Italy is an ignorant country.
They don't want to learn. They don't want to know. They don't.
And this one guy, David, this is Bellamy's friend. He's like,
the fact that I am born here, I've lived my whole life here, and you don't consider me Italian makes Italy a racist country, not an ignorant country. It's a fact. That's what racism is. Racism is not just about, they're making me feel a certain way. Racism is about system, is about society. So the fact that a person is born here and immediately they come out the womb, they have to live their whole life until they're 18 as an immigrant, what does it say about the country and about yourself? You're lost.
As everyone's going back and forth, I'm recording, but I'm also watching, having this kind of out-of-body experience. Every single person I've ever seen as a Black Italian, they're in this room. Like, the first Black Italian to win a show like American Idol, the first Black Italian musician to get signed to a major label, Universal Records. Like, everyone is Black, everyone is young, artists, intellectuals.
and they're debating about being black in their time. Imagine if you could get into a room with like a young Langston Hughes, Zora Neale Hurston, Wallace Thurman. It's like the start of the Harlem Renaissance, and they haven't become famous yet.
For every nation, there is a generation that is the generation to start the fight.
I am in the room with all of the people. This group, they're like mapping out what it is to be black Italian for like the rest of that country's history.
This is the generation that have to do this because we all like first generation black Italian, all of us.
But like none of them are born citizens. They're not considered Italian. In modern Italian history, the first big wave of black immigration came from the African continent post-independence. So Bellamy is the child of immigrants of that generation. But in recent years, migrants have been arriving from Africa in boats on the Italian shores, and these boat landings are constantly in Italian news, kind of like the way we see undocumented immigration from Latin America reported here in the U.S. So in 2018, Italy's population was about 8-9% immigrants, with about a fifth of those coming from Africa. When I was there in 2018, native-born black Italians were pushing to get a birthright citizenship, but they were losing the battle. A politician named Matteo Salvini was the face of Italian politics, and he had just pushed through a law that people in Bellamy's world were freaking out about. It severely restricted the rights of immigrants, and the language around it was all about the threat that undocumented immigrants pose to Italy. And the face of undocumented immigrants in Italy is black people.
And when the law passed, I remember I started crying out of disbelief. So you can imagine how hard it became. Life became for us. Of course, when you see me, you see a black person, and I do not have, you know, my ID card with Italian citizenship written on my forehead. So you think I'm an immigrant, and so you fear me.
These kind of subtle things that have been boiling, a politician helps to channel that, and now it becomes more explicit.
Every week or so, you could read in newspaper, black people being physically attacked, black people being killed. It was crazy. Like, that's when I started really being afraid of being a black person in Italy.
And then, in August of 2019, a very, very big unexpected thing happens. This Trump-like leader of Italy gets ousted from power. And so I'm following the news, and I see on Facebook this group of black Italians in Rome is trying to seize the moment and change Italy's laws on birthright citizenship. And I just buy a plane ticket.
Gofen Mputubwele is a producer for the New Yorker Radio Hour. Our story continues in a moment.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from the New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs, because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick, and I'm back with our producer, Gofen Mputubwele.
Just to recap for a second, the U.S. has what we call jus soli, birthright citizenship. It's written into the 14th Amendment, which passed after the Civil War. The 14th Amendment settled the question of how do we view all the black people who are no longer property? And the answer is citizenship. Anyone born in this country from now on is a citizen, including the children of immigrants ever after. So for a few years, I've been talking to black people in Italy, children of immigrants who don't have birthright citizenship, and they want it. They want to be recognized as Italians in the country where they were born. So last fall, I go back to see how their fight is going.
I am very sleepy.
I fly to Rome.
I just flew over from New York
to meet some black Italians who are organizing a protest to try to change Italy's citizenship laws.
And realizing that my American passport makes me, I get to go through the express line.
So I'm here to follow this political moment, but I stop by a bookstore and in the train station, and I find this book that's come out since I was last in the country.
It's got a kid who seems to be, who's like black Italian. He's got an Afro, dark skin. Well, dark skin for a white person.
And it's written by an Italian named Sonny Olumati, which is a Nigerian last name.
On the back it says, "Dopo quella notte, io e Primo non saremmo stati più gli stessi." After that night, I and Primo would never be the same.
In that period that I'm gone, this network of black Italians, they're making a lot of black Italian art. One of the people that we hear from writes a novel. Someone writes a very James Baldwin-esque manifesto. They're making these things that are like articulating the contours of what it is to be black in Italy. The hair company, Pantene Pro-V, they approach Bellamy and they're like, will you be our hair ambassador?
With my own 4C Afro hair, like, let's put that in mind.
And Bellamy's like,
never, 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 ever in a million years I would have imagined that the day would come that you would see, like, you know, an ambassador of Pantene with Afro hair.
Stop hair shaming, Pantene.
They finally started giving us a chance to express ourselves.
So I'm here to follow this political moment, but I realize that there's like two levels of work going on. There's like this cultural work and there's this political work that these people I'm talking to in Rome are trying to do. The head guy, his name is Amin Noor. He is Somali Italian. He's a filmmaker. We talk, and his friend Paolo is there. He's in government, local government in Rome. And what they think they can pass is a tempered birthright citizenship, jus culturae. So not the law of the soil, but the law of the culture. It would grant them a path to citizenship that's way easier, and people could get it long before they turn 18.
Are you hopeful?
At one point, I asked, like, how are you feeling? Like, do you think that this can happen?
No, siamo sempre speranzosi.
And he's like, no, we're really hopeful. And Amin says, we don't hope, we believe and we fight no matter what. They're talking to legislators and trying to get this on the agenda. They organize a protest. A couple of months later, Paolo and the group are testifying before Parliament. The nationalist Salvini government is gone. So 2019 is over. And the feeling was like, this thing, if it's gonna happen, it's gotta happen in 2020. 2020 comes in Italy.
In Italy, a terrible milestone. The death toll from COVID-19 in that country now more than 3,400, surpassing the death toll in China, despite Italy's much smaller...
And so the moment passes. Bellamy, right,
our woman in Milan. She's in isolation, right? Quarantine, like all of us. And she says this really interesting thing. She's like, even when things are getting better in that things are reopening.
I literally got an anxiety attack because I was like, I did not have to face any racism at all. Oh my God, I actually have to deal with white people again.
That's March and April. May. In May,
Ahmaud Arbery,
an African American man being chased down.
The story of Ahmaud Arbery breaks.
I remember feeling extremely, extremely overwhelmed and just defeated.
Then, George Floyd.
I refused to look at the video because I was like, no, I can't. But it was pretty much impossible avoid seeing the pictures. And then, of course, you know, when you read about how he was assassinated and him yelling, I can breathe, and it's like, it's so brutal.
I think, like, that is just, like, bottom, rock bottom. So when the protests start here in the U.S., very quickly in Italy, you had all these white Italians denouncing in solidarity this act of racism in the U.S.
I have never, ever in my life seen Italy as a country take a stand against racism in such a unanimous and visible way. Never in my life. So that shocked me, but in a bad way. Why do Black American lives matter more than Black Italian lives?
So Bellamy, all the writers and artists in that room in Milan, the folks in Rome, Black Italians across the country.
When we noticed that there was an open door to discuss racism, we started yelling, this is how racism takes place in Italy. This is what we have been going through all these years. This is what you need to fight for with us. If you ignore us now, it means that you really are not anti-racist.
She's like, I have stuff on deck. I have a video that I had been holding up to about racism in Italy that I was just waiting for the right time to publish.
Where they talked about the racism that they faced throughout their lives. I'm like, okay, let me edit this video quick.
Mi devi dire tu come mi devo sentire.
It became viral.
All this cultural work that they've been doing for the past years, the fiction book, the memoir, the novels, like these things are like, okay, there's this moment now.
The mic was given to Black people.
And at these protests, you're seeing white people and Black people holding signs that say Black Lives Matter. And next to that sign, it says, "Ius soli, birthright citizenship."
I really got emotional because hundreds of thousands, probably millions, I don't know, but hundreds of thousands of people, of white people, went in the street to fight against racism together with us, validating our injustices and our pain. And it's something that I had never seen before in my life. It made me feel seen, and it made me feel like you are at least trying to understand what it feels like to be in my shoes, and you want to help me dismantle the system.
But at the same time, she told this story of her friend David that I mentioned at the beginning of the story. The day of a Black Lives Matter protest, these law enforcement folks came up and were like, hey.
Oh, hey, Yul, as if it was a dog. And they ask for his documents. They ask if he smoked, if he sold drugs. They ask what does he do for a living. The first thing he did was give them his documents.
on the ID, it states that, you know, he has Italian citizenship. And they still ask him, so where are you from?
I have the paper. It says I'm born in Italy. It says I'm a citizen. I'm from here.
They're really wanting him to say the country of his parents.
They keep pushing him and they keep pushing on it. And like,
he insisted in saying, I was born in this town, in the, you know, in this region. I live in Italy. They only let him go when he told them that he works with one of the biggest singers in Italy. He showed them the pictures and then they let him go. After humiliating him, after making him feel alienated, because Italian citizenship is not enough.
I have this kind of theory that I've come up with in my mind where it's like, there's like different buckets of belonging to a country. One, your physical presence there. You are there. Second thing, you have legal status. Like you're legally allowed to be there. And the third thing, you're like culturally a part of the place. These are three different channels or buckets or whatever we're constantly pushing on in a country to determine like who belongs. These things aren't linear. Like you're always constantly pushing on the different areas to try to assert your belonging to a country.
For every nation, there is a generation that is the generation to start the fight. Those assets or those tools, those weapons, then hopefully, you know, current generation, future generation.
When I was in that room with Bellamy and her friends in Milan, I was like, I feel like this is the Harlem Renaissance. And then I leave and I was like, I don't even really know what that means. But I feel it, like I feel it, like it feels really young and exciting and black and art. And so I'm like looking at the Harlem Renaissance and I'm looking at it and I'm looking at it and I'm reading what people were writing at the time. And for me, I was like, oh, this is the significance of that time. Black folks went from being a physical presence in the country to a legal presence to asserting our cultural presence in this country. The black artists of that generation were articulating in the face of really blatant white supremacy, this is why we belong here. This is how we belong here. This is what it looks like for us to belong here. We've been here. And this is us.
Gofena Putubwele is a producer for the New Yorker Radio Hour, and our story was a collaboration with WNYC's The United States of Anxiety. I'm David Remnick. That's the New Yorker Radio Hour for today. Thanks for listening. I hope you'll join us next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Kala Lea, David Krasnow, Caroline Lester, Gofen Mputubwele, Louis Mitchell, Michelle Moses, and Stephen Valentino, with help from Allison McAdam, Morgan Flannery, Mengfei Chen, and Emily Mann. Our story on birthright citizenship was produced with assistance from Marianne McCune and Verilyn Williams, and music courtesy of Hannes Brown, Matthias Dobler, and Tommy Kuti. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.
WNYC Studios is supported by W.W. Norton & Company, publishers of The Road to Freedom, Economics and the Good Society, by Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph E. Stiglitz. The Road to Freedom, essential reading for those committed to the American ideal of an economic and political system that delivers well-being, opportunity, and meaningful freedoms for all. The Road to Freedom, available now wherever books are sold.